Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
At one point in his new book, Kook, Peter Heller opines as follows, "Sometimes I catch myself being a person I wouldn't tolerate for 5 minutes at my own kitchen table, being a thoughtless, self-centered jerk." Kook, subtitled What Surfing Taught Me About Love, Life, and Catching the Perfect Wave, is in part the story of Heller's attempt to transcend jerk status. When we spoke recently, I pointed out, perhaps indelicately, that when he decided it would be therapeutic to learn to surf, he was at least a couple of decades older than most of his fellow beginners.
Yeah, I was 47, and in Huntington Beach, where I first started, they said, you know, hey, if you're over 30, you're always going to be riding a big, heavy longboard because it's the most stable. And pretty much, you know, I got a lot of pitying looks.
At least part of what drove you to learn to surf, apparently, was the conviction that it would make you a better person. Where did that notion come from?
Well, I'd always loved the ocean, and I had just done a really exhausting thing. I'd been on an expedition to Tibet, which was very rigorous, and I'd written a book about it, and I was kind of exhausted. And I thought, you know, I've done a big thing. Now, could I do a lot of little things for a while, or, you know, what should I do? And my romantic life wasn't really shaping up that great because I was a commitment phobe. And it just occurred to me, you know, I was just drawn to water. Maybe the way, you know, Ishmael and Moby Dick describes the way people are drawn to the sea. It just felt like a place that maybe I could find some meaning. And the sea seems forgiving, like it'll accept you however you show up.
Although Ishmael had some problems once he got out there with Ahab.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he did.
Well, once you began sitting on a surfboard and waiting for waves, were you surprised to learn that surfing hadn't made everybody else out there good people?
That was interesting. I mean, you know, my friend and I, he was a corporate lawyer that was having a tough year, and it started because he had a vacation coming up, and he asked me if I'd come and learn to surf with him. He'd been transferred to Huntington Beach. So we got some boards, and we ran right out to the pier, into the water, right at the pier at Huntington Beach, which is really not what you're supposed to do when you're a kook or a rank beginner. Mm-hmm. That's where, you know, the experts surf. It's sort of ground zero for surfing on the mainland United States. And a kook is not a neutral term. It carries a slug of derision, and it really means the guy that paddles up to the lineup of expert surfers and starts talking to them like it's a cocktail party and ignores, you know, all the finely tuned protocols of surf and drops in on other surfers and, you know, collides with them. And the first surfer I met told me that I was a bleeping kook and I should get the bleep out of the water before he bleeped me up. And it hurt my feelings. But the odd thing, Bill, is that, you know, after that one day and then the next of sort of just getting thumped, I found that there was nothing else that I'd rather do. All I wanted to do was go back into the surf and try and get a couple of seconds standing up on the board. It was weird.
Well, I can understand why you wanted to learn to surf, but I don't understand why you decided that you had to try to become a really good surfer in just a matter of months. Why the competitive aspect to this adventure?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of like the Plimpton thing, you know, could I be a professional quarterback in a year? That kind of thing had always intrigued me, you know, the full immersion, the steep learning curve. I always really loved that. I did an article for Men's Journal about learning to, you know, fly a plane in 20 days, and it was, you know, exciting. And I kind of liked the drink from the fire hose approach, but turns out that surfing is really, I mean, it's a life path, and people start when they're little kids, and, you know, they surf their whole lives. And I did end up going to a school where, you know, the oldest surfer was 89-year-old woman who was, you know, totally stoked. But it takes dedication. And also this idea, it was sort of like I needed a next book, and it was sort of like it was a gimmick, you know, could I go from kook to riding a big, fast, hollow wave in 6 months? And, you know, boy, wouldn't that make a good book. But, you know, once I got on the path of trying to learn to surf, I became humbled really quickly, and I learned that, you know, you can't just do that. And also, I invited the woman I was dating to come with me at the time on this long trip, and I found out that there were other more important things than maybe learning to surf that quickly, like learning how to love another person and learning about the oceans, which are in deep trouble, I came to find out.
A number of different people taught you things about surfing, practical stuff, of course, but also ways to think about what you were trying to do. Looking back, do you find yourself remembering a favorite teacher among all of them?
Yeah. I sort of had two favorites. One was the saint of Seal Beach. He was a reformed Hell's Angel who was disabled, and he'd hurt himself falling off a telephone pole as a lineman, and he'd fused all the bones in his lower right leg, and he taught himself to surf again. He'd been a passionate surfer, and he figured, you know, if he could teach himself to surf, he could probably teach anyone. And it turns out he's like the best surf instructor in the country. Like, investment bankers will fly from Chicago to take a lesson with this guy, and, you know, stars from Hollywood come down. But also he teaches autistic children, and he teaches older people, and he's created this sort of extended family there at Seal Beach. He's just this huge-hearted person, and, you know, he gets out in the parking lot and surfers come from all over the parking lot to give him a hug, and you hear these things like, I love you too. You know, it's like all I'd heard was, you know, bleep you too in Huntington Beach. And so he was an extraordinary person, and he made surfing really fun. And his main lesson was, you know, the person who's having the most fun is the best surfer. And I don't think he's right, you know. I mean, I sort of am a little more realistic than that, but I thought it was a great approach. And then the second guy was a guy in Mexico who was my age. He was a master champion in Mexico, and he had learned himself, you know. He'd like stolen a piece of plywood when he was six and started boogie boarding, and that's how he started. But he's a, you know, turned into this great, great surfer. And it was like the Karate Kid with him, following him around, because he didn't really believe in teaching. So he would just, you know, you'd paddle up to him and say, Leon, what's my lesson for the day? And he'd say, watch the peaks. That's what you should do today. Watch the peaks. And then he'd paddle off, and I'd be like, all right. And there's like 8-foot waves rolling in. I didn't really know what he meant, but I appreciated that approach also.
In the chapter titled The Tortoise and the Hare, you write, and I'm quoting now, us humans are certainly crackerjack smart. I mean, who else could think up mortgage derivatives? But if you measure intelligence as an ability to survive millions and millions of years as a species in harmony with one's environment, then whales have it all over us. I know you've written about whales before, but at what point in your quest to learn to surf did you begin thinking again about whales?
So we started the trip. We got an old Vanagon, an old 85 Vanagon, and I covered it with mosquito netting wherever I could, because the one thing Kim, my fiance at the time, the one thing she was terrified of was mosquitoes. We drove out to Huntington Beach, and we spent a month taking lessons, and then we drove down the coast of Baja, the Pacific coast of Baja, and we surfed at a lot of different breaks there. And 2 months into that trip, I got invited to go to Japan to cover the guys making the movie The Cove, who were sneaking into Taiji, to that inlet in Taiji where they kill the dolphins. And I ended up going with them, you know, halfway through the surf trip and paddling a surfboard into this inlet that was, you know, paint red with blood. You know, there was a small pod of pilot whales that, you know, were left from this massacre that were about to be spiked to death. And the whole thing, you know, it made such an impression on me. And I kind of came back from that trip, and I would like weep at night, you know, when I was going to sleep for weeks. And it really spoke to me about, you know, the struggles that the oceans are having. And I did a lot more reading about that. And that sort of, you know, changed the color of the rest of the surf trip, because I realized that in 2010, you can't just do, you know, endless summer. It's not just a lark. I mean, the medium that you're in, this incredible ocean, is really having a hard time. And so I began to think a lot more about whales after that.
You know, it struck me reading this book that there's an interesting tension operating throughout it. Sometimes you seem to be saying surfing really is the point of all your journeying, and that's sufficient. And then at other times you seem to be saying that learning to love somebody else well and fully, in this case, Kim, your wife, was the real purpose of the trip. Was it one or the other?
Listen, I'm a flawed individual, you know, at base. And basically, I'm a kook and I'm about everything that I do, you know. And I realize, you know, that inviting Kim seemed like a great idea. It seemed like a good idea to really try and get to know this person that I loved. But I didn't really trust that, you know. Like, when I said I loved someone before, it always meant that in the near future that they'd be really mad at me, you know. So so I invited Kim with the intention of, you know, really trying to get to know this person. And I don't know. I mean, still at times, you know, there's nothing I'd rather do than just take off and go surfing. I just was in Mexico for 3 weeks surfing. I just love it. On the other hand, you know, I really love learning to be patient, learning to be accepting, and, you know, having some commitment in my life. We got married on the trip, and it's been wonderful.
So even though you're speaking to me from Colorado, where you make your home, you're not living in a constant state of torture because, hey, there's no ocean there.
Yeah. I paddled this surfboard around the lake in front of our house, and it's pathetic, kind of. You know, people are always like, what are you doing? You know, are there waves here? You know, I had a kid ask me that. I'm like, no,
Well, landlocked as you are now, do you find yourself thinking back on a particular great ride? And if so, where and when did it occur? Because it's impossible to talk about somebody who writes a book about surfing without saying, did you find the perfect wave?
Yeah, definitely. There were two rides, and one I'm not going to talk about because it sort of comes at the end of the book. But there was one in Baja at a place called Scorpion Bay, which people had said, you know, you've got to go to this place. It's like a 10, you know, you're surfing all these waves. You don't realize how crappy they are until you go to Scorpion Bay and see a real perfect wave. So we took the 35-mile teeth-jarring washboard road. We let a lot of air out of the tires. We went 20 miles an hour, and still, you know, we arrived just rattled. And there was this beautifully curving bay, a little fishing village, and a point that had one, two, three smaller points made up this one jutting sort of peninsula. And each one had a long wave. And there I caught my first ride, and it was like, I know because I timed another surfer from where I had caught it. It was a 40-second ride, and that might not sound like a long time, but for a beginner surfer, it's like, you know, it's like endless. It was like heaven, and the wave was just broke evenly. It was sort of like the tear on a FedEx pack. That's how perfectly straight across. And I kind of, you know, I fell off my board at the end of that, and I just thought, you know, if a shark comes and takes me right now, that would be fine. I could die right now. It was so beautiful.
Peter Heller is the author of Kook, What Surfing Taught Me About Love, Life, and Catching the Perfect Wave. The book is published by Free Press, and the author joined me from KGNU in Boulder, Colorado. Peter, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thanks a lot for having me.
My conversation with Peter Heller about his new book, Kook, What Surfing Taught Me About Love, Life, and Catching the Perfect Wave, will be featured on this week's program. I'll also be talking to ESPN's Roger Bennett about Major League Soccer as the teams break for their Wednesday night All-Star game against Manchester United. We'll have a story about various concerns separating those who enjoy paddling along rivers from the people who own and occupy the land through which those rivers run. And if you think Florida State can't produce football players who are also Rhodes Scholars, have we got a Florida State football player who's a Rhodes Scholar for you? So, join us, and remember, you can always listen to the program at onlyagame.org.